Off the Ball.
In association with Air. Don't miss live and exclusive Premier League action this month on the Air Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
Pat Nevin, hello.
Hi, how you doing, chap? Very good.
Very good. It was all beautifully set up yesterday at Old Trafford. There was a moment where Jose Mourinho was waiting confidently in front of his team and patting them all on the back as they headed out. And Antonio Conte was at the far back end of the tunnel looking down and thinking to himself, I'm not spending 40 seconds standing beside Jose Mourinho in that tunnel. And off we went.
Yeah, oddly enough, the bit that got me was right at the end of the game when they had to do the handshake, and that was fine. But if you look at it closely, there's a little kind of gesture from Jose Mourinho to put his hand on Antonio Conte's back. And it's kind of, sorry, I don't really want to fight with you, mate. I'd rather be your mate. So, you know, it was always kind of going to be, I thought, we talked about it last week, and I thought Jose would stand back from it. And it was a sensible thing to do, and he did that.
What did you make of the game?
It was a wee bit better than I thought it was going to be. I thought it had been really turgid. Obviously, I think, like everyone, Chelsea started really well. They looked in pretty good nick for the first part of the game. As usual, Willian, as he has been recently, was in super form. And they looked really lively and really confident in comparison to what they were, particularly through some parts of January. Not all of January, but some parts of January. So it made for a decent game. But in the end, I think the poor one. And I think it was poor physique as much as anything else that won United the game.
So Lukaku aside, how powerful a team are Manchester United then? Compared to Chelsea, is there that big a gap?
Well, McTominay adds a bit, doesn't he? Matic, I think, was fantastic. Yeah. You know, the physical side of him was unbelievable. He was all over, you know, the Chelsea players as much as he possibly could. And considering you had, you know, what they had going forward, you know, Hazard to some degree, but they kept so close to them, were so well drilled. I was really impressed with them. So, yeah, you had Pogba on top of that. Lukaku's physical strength got him the first goal. And you can't argue with that. He was just a little bit stronger, and Christensen never got up in time. By the time he did get up and got his head cleared, the ball was in the back of the net. It made a big difference. It's not just to say United weren't a good team. They, of course, they are a good team. I don't think there was much between them. Just a wee bit physically stronger.
Yeah, interesting you mentioned the word phrase well-drilled there of Manchester United, because that the Willian goal, Kev, and McTominay's role in it, where he has Willian in his sights for much of his sprint back towards his own goal, you actually feel he's, I suppose, overly well-drilled in that instance. Yeah. Well, in detail to Mark Hazard.
He clearly had the job, yeah. He clearly had that man-marking job on Hazard, particularly in the first half. Hazard didn't stray too far from his more natural position, the inside left channel, I suppose. That's exactly where he was taking up playing a lot of the game. But the goal, the breakaway for Chelsea, it was brilliant how they worked it to break from defence that they did. United were a little bit exposed, but Scott McTominay made the error, and we spoke about it yesterday. It was an error, but I just think he was just adhering to what Mourinho had said to him. You stick with Eden Hazard, wherever Hazard goes, and as soon as Hazard then comes inside, what happened then? He comes inside and Willian runs off him, and he should have gone with the danger. He should have seen the danger, stayed with Willian, and Hazard played the ball in. So it was well worked, but McTominay was at fault, yeah, most definitely. But the thing is, Pat, like we'd spoken about this man-marking job last season. It was Herrera, of course, marking Hazard last season. And you'd mentioned something even last season. You can't believe maybe that Hazard didn't try to do something to affect Herrera, take him out of position, take him out of his comfort zone. The same happened again yesterday, and I'd maybe question Conte a little bit off the back of it as to why he didn't do that, but surely that conversation must have been had to Hazard. Look, if they do that job on you again, just take him away. Go and play in the left wing, go and play in the right wing, take McTominay away. But it just never happened, really.
Yeah, and when players, you know, they fit into a system and a position and a place, it's much easier for the defender because he knows exactly where he is. I think you're spot on. I think that's what you would expect and hope to happen. And it became less and less effective as the game went on, Eden Hazard. And, you know, but then again, we've all been told, we've all played in teams. I mean, you're probably not old enough. Did you play under Jack?
No.
So
I didn't know.
Jack was probably exactly like that as well. So you do your job. You stay with exactly where you were.
Yeah.
I remember talking to Sheets about that. You know, and Sheets had plenty more to his game. But Kevin Sheedy had to stay left and get that ball in the middle, full stop, get on with it, matey. He did really well. And there's sometimes it's just like that. You're playing within a system and you have to give yourself up to it, even if you think, you know, it's, there's a more intelligent thing to do. Dead interesting what you said about McTominay thing, because my first view of that was I thought McTominay had passed him on, you know, to the centre-back.
Yeah, to Smalling.
You're right. It hadn't. It was different, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He was actually looking elsewhere. But that my first thought was, yes, it's McTominay's fault. But I read it slightly differently for you. But I think you're right.
Mm. Well, Chris Smalling's reaction when he turned around and realised McTominay had gone towards the ball and Hazard, he just couldn't believe. And I, you know, it's a very interesting one, and it's tough for a young player, because I would firmly believe McTominay has not gone through the underage system and graduated to the first team without he has spent a decade in that scenario where he would have tracked Willian all the way, because it's just a no-brainer. It's just what you do. It's clearly you're looking after that potential threat as the move unfolds. And it's as Kev said, well, you see, it's so tough when you're a young player, and Mourinho has probably said to you, don't leave Hazard. And it's almost as if he's sprinting back at Willian and suddenly realises Hazard's on the ball and thinks, oh my God, what if this guy beats two men and scores a goal? They're going to say, well, what was I doing? And I think he kind of ignored his instincts, yeah. His better instincts in this instance. And it's a really interesting one. I mean, he's a young player, so maybe you give him a pass, but it was a bad one.
You make a good point there as well. He certainly would have never had any sort of man-marking role when he's come through the system at United. He would have probably been the best midfield player coming through at 14, 15, 16, whatever it is. Now, all of a sudden, now it's amazing when you get to professional level and you've got to modify your own game to try and get longevity in the first team. That is the case here with McTominay. He's had to modify his game yesterday. Mm. And one moment, it was only one lapse in concentration, and it cost the team, almost cost the team overall, yeah. Mm.
I 100% agree with it. But I hate to point a finger at him purely because, you know, I thought one thing, Kev thought a completely different thing. And this has all happened lightning speed.
Yeah.
Extraordinarily good players.
Yeah.
I'm not going to point the finger at them. I don't think anyone would point the finger at them. But certainly, and one thing is this for sure, Mourinho will clarify that so that next time he will know exactly what to do. And if the goal scored, it won't be because of he didn't do what he was told to do. It will be because the tactic was wrong. But their tactics were pretty good. And to be honest, that first period where Chelsea were getting a few gaps and a few spaces, slowly but surely through the game, they were strangled up until that last moment when Morata scored and they didn't get the goal. Mm. I had to bring that up, didn't I?
No goals in 9 games for Morata. And Lukaku, Kev,
yeah,
you were impressed with him. It's his first time scoring against a team this season in the top 8, which is a not great statistic, but you thought he was good.
Yeah, he was good. He was good. You say with Morata as well, I think it's only 4 goals since the end of September. We spoke about him so glowingly at the start of the season, Pat and I, when we mentioned this, the movement, he's you know, how destructive he is. If he's got someone like Fabregas in the side that can pick him out of these passes, it's just not happening for him at the moment. His hold-up play was quite poor yesterday as well. So Graeme Souness touched on it post-match, saying the difference in the game was the two strikers. And yet Lukaku, for all that we spoke about him, and Pat and I again would have spoken about him regularly over the last few weeks, his hold-up play yesterday was a lot better. And I think in the early stage of the game, he had to work his way into the game. I think he wasn't necessarily involved earlier on, but I think as the game progressed, it got better and better. And you mentioned earlier on his movement for the second goal and the creating of that second goal for Lingard was simply outstanding. And Mourinho then spoken quite openly post-match about that run he had at the end. That's the sort of thing that leaves the... when crowds leave the game, that is the last moment that they're thinking, or that is the thing that's fresh in the mind. And that's the sort of thing you want to see from Lukaku, picking up the ball, driving at opponents, because he's got so much pace and power.
Mm. Impressed, Pat?
Yeah, he just has to do it all the time because he's capable of doing it all the time. But he doesn't do it all the time. We chatted about the recent Newcastle game, and it was as if, well, he played a bit better than Pogba, but it was as if both of them just weren't that interested in the game. If you're going to be a world-class player, which I always underline, Lukaku can be. He can be the best striker in the world. There's no doubt about it. He's got the physique. He's an actual goal scorer. We saw that pace. Now, it's not just the fact that he made that run that you're talking about there, Kev. It's he made that run against damn quick players.
Yeah.
And he left them in the trail. Mm. That's the bit that got the gasp from everybody as well. Because you don't usually leave, you know, because they're pretty quick in that midfield in Chelsea, particularly N'Golo Kante, who was an interesting story in himself. Kante, who's a fabulous player and can always just about outdo anyone, he was smothered for large parts of that game, and that was really impressive. So once again, you talk to about Mourinho again, because it comes back to that. He sees where the problems are, he sees where the dangers are, and he seems to always find a way to snuff them out. And for whatever people say, and a lot of Man United fans are fed up with Mourinho, are fed up now and again with him, win your games and he'll win your trophies in the end, and certainly he'll get you into Europe with a shadow of a doubt.
And he's managed to brilliantly nullify Alexis Sanchez and turn him into a fine workhorse of a player in really quick time. He's really knocked all the good stuff off Sanchez's game really nicely.
Right. I'm trying for a musical analogy here, right?
Okay, go on. This will go over my head.
No, it won't. Absolutely won't. Do you know who was the great producer? And you kind of just after the Motown day, Spector, Phil Spector.
Yeah.
Right, and he used to get all the best musicians that there were in the business, and then make them play the same notes time and time and time and time and time again, until they all sounded exactly the same, and he got his wall of sound. So you took all the individualism, or a lot of the individualism away, and created a wall. Do you know, it's not the way we all want to see it, but bloody hell, Phil Spector was a good producer. He made some great music over the years with that wall of sound. Mourinho's like that. I mean, I'm quite pleased with that analogy.
That is magnificent. You've even outdone yourself. Did that just come to you, or did you dream that up earlier?
Just came at me right there, and it makes perfect sense.
I'd clap if it didn't. If clapping didn't sound so bad on the radio, I'd clap. You'll see that on Twitter,
you know,
very shortly. Huh?
You know exactly what I mean.
He's ruining the fun.
He'll do that to Sanchez. He'll drag you down to build you back.
Do you know what, Pat, as well? I think it's just emphasised the point even more so with De Bruyne and Mo Salah playing so well. That's what maybe hits home even more, what he's done with certain players.
Yeah, certain players can't cope with it, you know. And again, we've all worked under managers. When I was a very young kid, I nearly signed for Dundee United, and the manager there was a guy called Jim McLean. And I probably wouldn't have lasted in football had I signed for them instead of signing for Celtic as a kid, because the personality would have been just drumming all the individuality out of me, and I just wouldn't have fancied it. I'd have said, no, I'll go and be a teacher or something. But you know, if you're at that level, and he needs to be able to do that, and the guys that he can't do that with, he'll just throw them aside.
Mm. The Pep Guardiola yellow ribbon story is a very interesting one. I'm sure it caught your eye. So, as everybody I think knows at this stage, because he's been wearing it since November, he's wearing the yellow ribbon in support of jailed members of the Catalan independence movement. Even interestingly, a couple of weeks ago, his private plane was searched when it landed in Barcelona. They thought he was smuggling in the former Catalan president, which it turned out he wasn't. So he's in deep with this movement and feels very passionately about it. The FA deemed the yellow ribbon a political symbol, and they have a zero tolerance policy on political symbols, aside from the poppy, which we can talk about another time. UEFA, interestingly, as Pep has pointed out, only have an issue with political symbols if they are deemed offensive. And his argument is, I can wear this in the Champions League and there's no issue because it's not deemed offensive. So what do you make of all this and the FA's zero tolerance policy, and how Pep is dealing with the whole story?
Most annoyingly, I can see it from both sides, 100%. Certainly from Pep's side. If you listen to Pep speak about it, there's some really good clips out there about him talking about it. It was on the BBC website, which I looked at and listened to today, and he spoke absolutely beautifully about it. And you could almost not find any offence, no matter who you are. And that's saying a lot when political people are tuned into this sort of thing. The difficulty is, so I'm not going to disagree with him wearing it and the strength of his feeling and the purity of his thoughts and the purity of his feelings. And I wouldn't argue that. And I would not argue that for a second. Mm. But it does come back. You don't mention the poppy, but the poppy's the same thing. You know, and it's classically, if people don't find it offensive, well, bad news, guys. It's the old phrase, a lot of people say, one man's freedom fighters and another man's terrorist.
Yeah.
So, you know, who's it offensive to? It depends. Now, it may well be that I personally am offended with right-wing racists, but it may well be that some people aren't. So as soon as you decide, okay, then you're allowed to use political signifiers on your clothing at games, that's all fine.
Mm.
But if you're going to be realistic about it, you kind of got to let everybody do it, even the stuff you don't kind of like. Mm. And that's a bit that kind of worries me. So I'm not against Pep doing it. He's going to take the hit on it. I do applaud him for it, because you start then looking at other political symbols, such as the American gridiron players taking the knee. and I'm not going to argue with them for doing that. I would probably be kneeling there beside them. It's a very, very slippery slope, and it's one that when you go down, you will find yourself in very, very sticky waters that you won't know what to do with.
Yeah, precisely. And Poppy aside, the FA have been fairly consistent on this. Robbie Fowler, very memorably, you're going back 20 years now, but he came out in support of the Dockers. The kind of thing I think most people wouldn't deem offensive, to say the least, and probably would be on Robbie Fowler's side there, but he was punished. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have Anelka, who did the Cunnell in 2014. He got 5 matches, and that's deemed to be an inverted Nazi salute on his anti-Semitic, and Anelka tried to argue it wasn't, but he was hit with 5 games. UEFA's stance is very interesting. I mean, it does open up a minefield, as you said. A political view can be legitimate and horribly offensive to lots of people. Like, we see all the time, Brazilian players often have T-shirts, "I belong to Jesus," and yet you wonder how a Western audience, who don't seem to have a problem with that, might feel about Allah Akbar on a T-shirt, you know? And then you get into all this territory about what is offence. So I think Pep also has to take the hit on this, whether that's fair or not, and it's a zero tolerance policy. This is politically and offensive or inoffensive. I think it's only right he's going to be fined. I think, by the way, he's going to keep paying the fine and keep wearing the yellow ribbon. 15 million quid a year will help you with that.
Yeah, sure it will, yeah.
And isn't there a bit, like, again, I'm quite a political animal myself, and I've been involved with a number of political, you know, statements and positions and, you know, debates. I tend to keep it away from the actual playing of the football game. I like keeping it away from the playing of the football game. If someone asks me away from that, and okay, I'm representing me then, then I'll talk to you about whatever one it is, you know, whatever political discussion it has. In fact, I was on a programme that's, you know, Question Time in the UK.
Oh, yeah.
I was on the kind of the kind of reaction to that Question Time the other night, and people were giving us the big eyebrow because I was on it. I'm thinking, yeah, I played football, but I'm allowed to have an opinion. But it's bringing it actually onto the actual stage. I have a real sadness with, because even if I totally and utterly agree with it, it just opens up, because, you know, I'm a libertarian at heart as well, which means if I, it's a classic Neuberger quote, isn't it? Which, they came for one, then they came for the other. Eventually, where do you draw the line? You don't know where to draw the line.
Yeah, and I suppose you have to respect the platform that you've been given. And it's tricky. And we're going to talk later on, so you don't have to, we're tight for time here. But even everybody, I suppose, is a hypocrite if you dig down deep enough. And Guardiola, in his press conference afterwards, Rob Harris, who we'll have on later on, said to him, "Well, you know, 10 years ago you were a paid ambassador for Qatar's World Cup bid and took a lot of money there. And also, what do you make of Sheikh Mansour and the boys?" Mansour is the deputy prime minister in the UAE. And Amnesty International have talked about how Mansour, and so I suppose by extension that country, they've continued to arbitrarily restrict freedoms of expression and association. And there's a lot of criticisms of how they operate. And Guardiola's answer was kind of wishy-washy. He said, every country decides they want the way they want to live for themselves. And if he, Sheikh Mansour, decides to live in that country, it is what it is. I mean, he's not just living in the country, Sheikh Mansour, he's the deputy prime minister. So it's fair to say he's having a bit of a role in how things are done. So again, you know, if you really want to get into the rights and wrongs of Pep and his brilliance and how well he talks about Catalan independence, I mean, he's not streaky clean on this either.
Absolutely not. I mean, it's easy to almost, there is no one who is whiter than white in these situations.
Correct.
Cleaner than clean in these situations. I often, if I'm speaking out about the fact that I don't like, you know, political or, you know, sectarian or whatever, or racist stuff at football games, and then people will go, "Oh, you're a Chelsea fan. Isn't the case that they had the most racist fans for years and years and years?" And it's hard to argue against that, other than the fact that from the moment I walked in there, I made my point to them people every single time that I was not accepting of that and I hated that. So you can accept it. You know, you will not be always on exactly the right side, as long as you make it clear where your position is. Pep's situation there would have been, "I don't agree with it, but he does what he wants." You know, you can't tell everybody else how to live.
You wanted to make a last.
No, I don't know. I don't know. We're probably out of time. It's maybe even to get involved with next week, I suppose, as well. To your Pap, you mentioned Willian earlier on. Willian only his 14th start on Sunday, 15 starts last season in the Premier League. Why Why does Conte continuously overlook him when he's plays such a big part in such a big game, particularly when you look at the Barcelona game last week as well?
I've seen most, if not all, Chelsea games this season and last season, and he isn't always this good, to be honest. There are games when he looks quiet and he looks weak and he doesn't look anywhere near himself. Confidence looks as if it's short sometimes if he's been left out for a while. That's not been the case recently. And I think if he got a game every single week, he'd be fine. I mean, if Hazard did go at the end of the season and Willian got a whole bunch more games, you know, he wouldn't be a bad replacement. He'd be absolutely fine there. So, you know, you wouldn't want to lose Hazard from that club. But, you know, Willian's an absolutely fantastic player. And just about anywhere else he would be getting a game because, as we said before, his attitude is absolutely fantastic. By the way, you lot are out of time. You've no idea what I've got to do now.
Go on.
Right here. I've not been to my game this weekend yet. After I stop here, I'm in the Scottish Borders. I'm jumping in my car, driving to Edinburgh. I'm getting a flight to London. I have to get across to Swansea, do Swansea tomorrow night against Sheffield Wednesday. And then come back the same way the next day. That doesn't seem much, except have you seen the weather?
Yeah. Oh my. I'll see you in Swansea tomorrow night. I'm actually there as well, so yeah.
Good luck. You're getting there as well. I'm coming for the north. It should be a cracker.
Every football commentator, pundit secretly wants Swansea relegated, and I know you all do.
No, it's true.
It's great. True. The moaning that goes on.
Let's get Big John on to talk about Swansea.
Pat, thanks a million.
Pleasure, guys.
All right.
Off the ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm prepared to anything I can
well,
to play
the
country again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
We should have been an honest answer would be a mistake.
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Henry Winter from The Times will join us in the show this evening. We'll have Rob Harris as well, who was causing Guardiola some trouble in his press conference after he won the Carabao Cup, first leg of a treble.
Okay. Yeah. I think I was talking about it yesterday as well, with that as well. I heard Richie was talking about maybe the importance of the cup, and I think maybe many might dismiss it. But the way I'd look at it is, there's very few clubs that get the opportunity, or very few players across the course of the career that will win trophies. And you only need to look at maybe Kyle Walker was probably the one that stuck out for me, Joe. Kyle Walker has been at Tottenham, desperately wanted to leave for trophies. Of course, financial rewards would have come with it as well. That's the first time now he would have won a trophy. Now, all of a sudden, now he's looking beyond it and you're thinking, yeah, this could be the first of, you would say, at least, the very least, two for City this season, perhaps even three.
Mm. So we've got Winter and Harris on the way, and it was another, I would say, pretty good Premier League weekend.
Taken quickly. Chamberlain, he's got it through to Salah, and Salah's got it into the net yet again. Every game a goal for Liverpool's brilliant Egyptian. Adrian's out, but he's been beaten. And I think West Ham have been beaten now for sure, because Roberto Firmino has scored his customary goal. He's netted in three in a row. Robertson. Mane.
Over 2 minutes to go. Eriksen's corner. Kane is arriving and Kane scores! The Palace resistance finally broken after such a brave, determined battle.
Hazard now is Smalling for company, has to hold on to the ball and then forward through to Willian. Chance for Chelsea here. Willian inside the area and Willian scores for Chelsea! Wonderful counter-attacking move. Here's Sanchez. Sanchez through to Martial. Now it's Lukaku. 6 yards out. Romelu Lukaku equalises for Manchester United. The air for Lukaku is forced to drift down to the right-hand side. Couple of little step-overs. Cross in there towards Jesse Lingard. And the substitute puts Manchester United in front.
There's Aguero right through the middle. Sergio Aguero. Scourge of Arsenal again. Gundogan batted in by Vincent Kompany.
It's so
and he's got one.
Worthy winners of the Carabao Cup.
And watch out for the treble.
There we are. So lots going on. Kev was at Old Trafford. We've talked about that already. We might touch on a few other points Kev wanted to make. We also have Rob Harris on the line, global football writer for AP. Evening, Rob.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. So you're the one who's causing all this trouble for Pep Guardiola in his press conference, I see.
Well, I mean, it was quite an interesting occasion yesterday at Wembley. In fact, I don't think I've ever been in a post-match press conference like it, where, I mean, often we're used to sort of controversies often emerging even after a final about a manager's future. But this was basically a political press conference. I mean, obviously, he had to be asked, as he was, by someone about his wearing of the ribbon, even in defiance of the FA charge, which came on Friday. But then it was like the repeated questions he kept on discussing it. I mean, obviously, we do encourage managers and indeed players to be vocal in their opinions. In fact, one of the things we often say is, you know, that restraining themselves can be quite bland. And here was a case of actually someone saying what he thinks. I was probably quite surprised that he didn't at some point say, I've addressed that and I want to sort of focus now on the success today. What was key, though, to me is the fact that as these questions kept on, as he kept on answering these questions, discussing Catalonia, and his key message actually is the right of the Catalan people to have their voice heard, for democracy effectively not to be suppressed, because that's the background to all this, the referendum that was held in October, which the Madrid authorities say was illegal, shouldn't have taken place. It then led to this declaration of independence, which was quashed. It led to some of the leaders fleeing. It led to some of the activists being imprisoned. And against this backdrop, Guardiola was sort of called strongly for democracy to be recognised. How does this play in directly to Manchester City? Well, what we haven't heard much is questions about Manchester City's ownership. We're used to hearing many things around Qatar in the Middle East about some of the human rights issues around there. But actually, the activists like Amnesty, like Human Rights Watch, have for several years flagged up what they see as concerns around worker and migrant rights and abuses in the UAE. And the UAE, a deputy prime minister of the UAE, is Sheikh Mansour, who is the owner of Manchester City. So I did ask Pep Guardiola just how, you know, how he reconciled these two facts. Obviously, he's quite vocal in sort of calling for democracy in Catalonia to be recognised, but there are concerns and questions over whether or not democratic freedoms can fully exist within the UAE. That's quite a long-winded answer, but it's quite a complex issue.
Mm. No, you've explained that all brilliantly. And I thought his answer was very disappointing, you know? I mean, clearly, look, he's backed into a corner here. The reality is he's saying to himself, well, look, I'm from Catalonia. And of course, this is an issue close to my heart. And ultimately, if I couldn't work for everybody who owned a football club who had some kind of dodgy past, then I probably wouldn't be managing any Champions League club ever. You know, it's a difficult one. And so I just, you know, I got to pick and choose my battles here. And is there an element of hypocrisy? Yes, there is. And did I take money from Qatar for their World Cup bid? Yes, I did. And yes, I am working for Sheikh Mansour. There was just something so poor about his answer, which was every country decides the way they want to live for themselves. If he, as in Sheikh Mansour, decides to live in that country, it is what it is. The old classic of it is what it is. And also the notion that Sheikh Mansour is only passively living in that country as opposed to being deputy prime minister over the area, again, is conveniently forgotten. Like, it's as weak as it gets, really. It's actually quite disappointing for somebody who is as smart and intelligent as Pep. Now, I dare say most people would have applauded the honesty if he had said, yeah, look, it's a bit tricky for me. And I understand there's a, you know, people might think there's a degree of hypocrisy, but I've just chosen, you know, I got to live my life and I got to choose my bits and blah, 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 blah. But to not even pretend that Sheikh Mansour has any kind of jurisdiction over what's going on in UAE, or that he was an ambassador for Qatar. Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of curious how that was greeted in the room. Was there a silence and a moment of, well, do we bother even following up on that nonsense?
I mean, I think obviously there was probably a shock that I'd actually followed up and pressed him on a point connected to it. I mean, was going through my mind, do I bring this up? I mean, it has, you know, been on my mind for some time, you know, given the fact we do often focus on Qatar, connected with the World Cup, connected with Paris Saint-Germain, is whether or not we should pay more attention, scrutinise the role of the UAE, which some of the rights groups do flag up. And I think Guardiola was probably slightly startled to actually be challenged in that way, which led to him sort of giving a quite a vague response where, you know, he probably hadn't expected those questions to come back at him. But, you know, some people might say, well, this is a football press conference. What are you doing asking about these issues in a football press conference? And as it's like, you know, the fact is he'd sort of turned it into this political pulpit almost, sitting in front of the Carabao branding, which is also right. slightly incongruous for the occasion, which sort of then meant, and I was thinking, well, you know, do I need to address this in print if we are discussing this linking to the ownership? And then what is the thing we're often accused of? Well, would you say that to someone's face? So I thought, well, I need to raise this up with him to just get his take on how he does reconcile the his championing of democracy in Catalonia and what some rights groups say is potentially the suppression of freedoms within the UAE. I mean, it's quite interesting you bring up his past role with Qatar. He was a bid ambassador to Qatar. Now there is a geopolitical dispute taking place in the region, which means the UAE and Qatar are loggerheads. I was actually remembering a moment from during that World Cup bid where I was given an interview with Guardiola. It's actually at Stamford Bridge. He was the bid ambassador. And I was told I couldn't ask anything about football. I could only ask about Qatar. Right. And I was sort of left sort of scrambling around asking certain questions. And it reminded me, actually, around that time, the sort of questions we were thinking about Qatar, this was around sort of 2009, were things like, you know, does it have a football culture? Is it too hot? The rights issues only really emerged after they won the bid in 2010. And then the questions started to emerge around Qatar. So that might explain why he was not asked about it significantly during the bid. I mean, it's a failing as us as journalists. In fact, we only sort of were onto that after the bid. The sure. scrutiny has increased. And I think the whole football and sports reporting world has changed in the last 10 years or so. Now, there is a great awareness of societal issues, you know, and how the impact on populations and human rights, in part due to Qatar, which means actually there is this now focus on many parts of the world. I mean, it's why even some discuss around the USA bid for the 2026 World Cup with Canada and Mexico. Mm. You know, we start to look, you know, death things like the death penalty. How does that fit into things? I mean, you know, we have a greater awareness, I think, now yeah. of these issues. I mean, and, you know, we don't necessarily have all the answers.
And on Qatar, I mean, some of the human rights abuses, the more egregious ones, would only have really kicked off in a big way once they'd won the bid and started building the stadiums. And so you could argue, in fairness to Guardiola, well, he mightn't have been fully aware of things. One, you would say, well, you should be as aware as possible if you're going to be the ambassador for a bid. But two, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think he's ever come out retrospectively and said, you know what's going on there is abhorrent and the human rights crimes are a disgrace and I'm really upset at the way this bid has gone. He's never done that, and you have to class that as a bit of a disappointment. Again, it's all in the context of when you're sticking your head above the parapet and being a moral compass on one political issue and then so clearly ducking and diving on another.
Yeah, exactly. And some people were sort of asking me on Twitter in relation to this question about, you know, my views and such forth. Well, I'm not setting myself up as a moral champion. I'm not expressing political views myself. I'm not championing political causes myself, whereas he actively is, wearing the yellow ribbon, speaking out quite vocally on a particular issue. So he's setting himself apart and setting himself up to discuss these issues, which he obviously has every right to. Mm. Then in return, he can face these sort of questions in reverse. And that is a key point actually on Qatar about the fact that the projects did start to be built after the 2010 bid and then won. And then obviously you start to sort of see various development work, which led to this scrutiny. But I think what people forget is, I mean, a lot of the attention in Qatar has been on this thing called kafala, which are the labour laws that effectively tie migrant workers to their employer. It restricts their rights and some of their freedoms, which Qatar is under pressure being forced to say it will remove. It still hasn't actually fully abolished it as it said it would. It has introduced other reforms. But the same labour system actually exists in the UAE as well. Yeah. But you wouldn't necessarily know that because actually so much of the scrutiny has been on Qatar. Yet actually the UAE holds the FIFA Club World Cup and other FIFA events. And even FIFA sort of tried to gloss over the fact, well, even they are sort of looking at Qatar and actually sort of making them clamp down on some of the more grievous abuses. But I mean, it just shows actually how, you know, tournaments, football, it's so much more than just a sporting thing. I mean, the whole reason you could say maybe that Manchester City was bought by the UAE was a sort of expression of soft power. It's a way of projecting Abu Dhabi influence on the world, just in the same way Qatar bought PSG as well. So, I mean, the collision between geopolitics and sport is burning brightly, and this just sort of serves to reinforce that.
Right, Rob. The FA spoke to Guardiola about this in December, and of course then we know that they given two formal warnings, which were ignored, and then of course there was a fine for him just last week. So where do they stand in this, given the fact is that they defied FIFA in wearing the pop it was last year in an England international, didn't they? But where do they fit into all this now then, and what will the future punishment be then for Guardiola going forward if he continues to defy this?
Yeah, I mean, there is a heavily conflicted position, as you say, from the FA. I mean, he is facing probably at first a fine. If he continues to wear the ribbon, he could end up with a touchline ban. I mean, it's clearly a political message. Mm. It's the same thing, though, people say the poppy represented a political message. What the FA tried to tell FIFA, or did tell FIFA, is the fact this is representing sort of past wars. It's honouring the war dead. But actually, in getting the rules relaxed, and this was something discussed around FIFA at the time and quite widely, is the fact it's very hard to judge things on a case-by-case basis. Although Britain says it's honouring its war dead with the poppy, if another country, if Syria, if other countries decide that they want to honour their victims from more recent wars, they are far more politically sensitive. And if you were to see the Syrian national team perhaps wearing symbols that reflected some of the victims of the conflict there at the moment, it would be seen as quite an incendiary thing, potentially.
Sure.
And that's why, actually, it would have been far more sensible for FIFA at the time of this dispute with the FA over the pop is to actually just ban all symbols and not have any additional symbols.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's the wider context. And actually, you know, you mentioned the poppy. James McLean is a perfect example over here. The people are very familiar with. He certainly doesn't see it as a harmless symbol that's not loaded politically. The issue with UEFA and FIFA is that their line on it, as opposed to the FA, who have a zero tolerance ban, is they don't want the political symbols on display if they are deemed offensive. And I mean, where do you even start with that? Because one person's perfectly acceptable symbol is absolutely outrageous for a whole quotient of other people. I mean, that's an absolute minefield.
Yeah, and because the poppy as well is honouring all British war dead, and some of the more recent wars have actually been very politically sensitive around the world. They have not been universally popular, which means it is a potentially controversial symbol in some parts of the world, while at the same time there is a very noble cause behind the poppy, which is actually raising funds to help support families and help support casualties of war and, you know, the various sort of charitable causes around it. But it is quite a sensitive thing. It's why actually it did lead ultimately, when this whole dispute with the FA and FIFA was underway over the poppy, it did lead then to a revisiting of the Easter Rising and the commemorations around the centenary of that, because actually some others around the FIFA world then started to point out to the leadership around FIFA, well, what about, look what Ireland did. So it did lead and highlight the complexities of this, which we now reach this point now, whereas actually Guardiola is trying to, what he sees, exercise his right to stand up for his fellow Catalonians, and he's facing sanctions from the FA. I mean, it's quite intriguing, actually. Guardiola is sort of, seems to have actually never directly said he supports Catalonian independence, but he's given heavy backing to the Catalonian leadership and their right to pursue in the referendum and to pursue the cause that they believe in. Because he's obviously can't necessarily foresee his own future. Maybe he would want to be manager of the Spain national team one day. So maybe he's sort of trying to balance that off at the same time. But I mean, it's a very complex situation, obviously, in Spain at the moment. It's obviously out of the headlines, but it's still this standoff where you've got politicians effectively in exile, you've got others imprisoned, and there is this whole movement still obviously pushing for independence, which Madrid is asserting its sovereignty over Catalonia still.
Mm. And one last quick point. When he's talking in his press conference, and as you said, there's no hint of let's move off this now, he's more than happy to elaborate and talk about it. Is he getting very passionate? Is he banging the table? How would you describe his demeanour? And how impressive a speaker on this particular issue was he, even if he wasn't so hot on UAE and Qatar?
Yeah, I mean, he's very passionate. It wasn't a rant. It wasn't, you know, he was actually very considered, very measured, offering his opinions. And we often, I suppose, don't hear that from managers or indeed from players. I remember back to Euro 2016. I think it was Harry Kane who was asked after the Brexit referendum about his thoughts, and he basically had nothing to say. And that was a sort of theme around the team. Now, you don't necessarily have to have a direct opinion on the referendum, but there was this sense of disinterest, I would say, around the England team, whereas actually you had, I think, Cellini, who was giving a view elsewhere at the Euros, and others feel more confident in the world of football of actually expressing an opinion. The problem is many players are actually wary of stepping into the political arena, and maybe this is one of the reasons why, actually.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
There can be repercussions.
Oh, very interesting. We'll see how it plays out. I somehow suspect he'll take his fine, pay that, and continue to wear the ribbon, but we'll see. Rob Harris from AP. Thanks so much, Rob.
Good to join you.
Thanks, Rob.
Cheers.
Off the ball.
In association with AIR. Don't miss live and exclusive Premier League action this month on the AIR Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
Look at Mustafi there in the middle. Stronger than that. It's pathetic defending. He's walking. Xhaka's walking. Ozil walking. They're walking. Don't walk at Wembley. Don't walk on a football pitch. It's impossible. You're 2-0 down. Run. Look at Xhaka and Ramsey going back. Look at them getting back. Central midfield players.
Silver. Walk.
Are you talking to me? And this is a great, great goal. Forget Arsenal, I'll come on to them in a minute because they're a disgrace.
Alex Iwobi.
Who's he coming off for?
I think it's Ramsey.
And you're on a seven. Struggling short with words now to describe this Arsenal pattern. This ingrained pattern, embedded pattern now that we've seen. I've not really liked the defending for a long time. I've not really liked the leadership, the character for a long time, and the spirit on the pitch, but you've always liked the football. I don't even like the football anymore. The last bastion has gone. It's not even a team that plays good football.
What more can you say? I don't know. It's crazy, isn't it? It's a crazy situation. It really is.
Genuinely getting angrier as the game unfolded.
Yeah, I was watching it yesterday, just listening to him, and I would never have heard, I said to you earlier on, I never would have heard a co-commentator be that critical, coming out with views like that. Junior, you've heard it obviously post-match and even half-time, even pre-match at times, but never from the co-commentator during the game. But it was that obvious watching it. You could clearly see what was happening on the pitch.
Mm. Henry Winter has joined us, I'm delighted to say, chief football writer with The Times. Evening, Henry.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Kev.
Hi, Henry.
Was it as bad for you as it was for Gary Neville?
Well, on a slight issue, for those of us who've never played professionally, it was quite encouraging that walking was now a part of the professionals' game. Because I think that the 40,000 Arsenal fans who were there and sort of overweight press journalists like me, you know, that just sort of gives us hope for the future if walking's part of the game. No, I absolutely agree with Gary Neville. I wasn't aware of it at the time because obviously I was at the match and watching it. But you know what? It is not a huge surprise to anyone who's been watching Arsenal recently. And the focus, quite rightly, from what Gary Neville was saying was on Mustafi and Xhaka and the fact that they weren't as committed as they should have been. But actually, if you then take Gary's quite reasonable argument on the next stage, which is the most important thing to do, who's responsible for that? And actually, it has to lie with the manager. And, you know, interesting, following a lot of the pundits' comments, not many of them are taking on the next stage as the Arsenal fans have, and that is actually pointing the finger at Arsene Wenger.
I mean, we've spoken about this so often now, and again, this becomes even more relevant now, I think, because, I mean, I read your match report today, Henry, and you've touched on maybe about you know, Wenger's demise and all these sort of things as well. Yes, okay, clearly that's happened. But it's the truly, and we spoke about it earlier, the owner's responsibility, Stan Kroenke here. Now he's, or the majority shareholder, should I say, he has allowed this to happen. He's allowed this to continuously go on and on and on. Now we've got to a stage where, as Gary Neville's touched on there, Henry, they're not even a good watch anymore, watching them play. They've had spells, yes, of course, but I think by and large over the last couple of years, it's been quite a poor watch, I think, watching Arsenal play the football. And that's the most alarming thing I would feel watching the demise.
Yeah, I mean, occasional good moments when sort of Ozil is playing well. But no, absolutely, they've been poor. But I don't think Kroenke will worry about the quality of the football.
Is it simply just about finances rolling in then for him?
Yeah, and he didn't sort of grow up in Denver with pictures of Liam Brady on his wall. You know, absolutely not that type at all. His interest is purely in financial, is in finishing in the Champions League positions, which clearly they haven't. They're unlikely to again. I think they're 10 points off the pace. They've got a difficult situation in terms of facing AC Milan, who have been inspired by Gattuso in the round of 16 in the Europa League. So that, you know, that is tricky for him, and that's why it could be a difficult summer. But the problem you've got a very strange dynamic within Arsenal at the moment, is that no one is really prepared to stand up to Arsene Wenger. And actually, that's unhealthy, whether you're in a radio station, whether you're in your newspaper, whatever walk of life you're in. If you've got someone who's just, the primacy is completely around him, is completely unchallengeable, that's unhealthy. There is no one challenging him since David Dean left and actually saying, Arsene, move a bit quicker and go for this player, and you might be able to get Mahrez or Kante in. Move a little bit more intelligently and you might have held on to Sanchez, maybe got his contract sorted out earlier. Why aren't you moving quicker with Jack Wilshere? So there's a kind of yes culture around Wenger, who's one of the people who actually interviewed Gazidis for the job, effectively the person who could dismiss him one day. That's not healthy. So we haven't seen this situation in terms of one individual being so powerful since Ferguson's days. And I think, in fairness to Gazidis, he's changing things. He's changing the structure around Wenger slowly. But he's got a huge decision to make in the summer with Kroenke.
I presume you may have seen it, maybe not before the match. I don't know how busy you were, but Ian Wright did a fantastic interview in the Times with David Walsh on Sunday. And, I mean, it was prescient in some respects, given what happened at Wembley in the afternoon. But he talked about spending some time with Wenger at the World Cup in 2014, and said he's such a fascinating man to talk to. And during our conversation, Wright says that Wenger accepts whatever criticism I make because it comes from a place of love. And you thought, well, you know, first and foremost, it's one of the many reasons I think we all like Arsene Wenger in a lot of ways, that intelligence and, you know, just a certain kind of dignity.
Man.
Yeah, dignity.
Yeah, and, absolutely. Dignity of the man. I mean, I've been one of his biggest critics for sort of 5-6 years. And you go and do football writers' events with Wenger. We had a fundraiser for Grenfell earlier in the season. Wenger turned up 2 days before the start of the season, knowing that he was going to be on a panel with individuals like me. Ian Wright was there, Gary Lineker was there, people who've been sort of critical of him, having also huge admiration for what he's done in the past, the Invincibles, the double winners, and also huge admiration for his credibility and integrity and ability, in a way, without getting too sort of highfalutin, as a man. And also in the room, there are probably, 200 people there, probably about 30 of them were Arsene Wenger out Arsenal fans, and he just dealt with it with such class, with such dignity. And the statue outside the Emirates is completely deserved. The legacy is completely deserved. What I worry about, as someone who admires him as a man and has admired him as a manager, is that the legacy is being slightly tarnished by this drift.
Well, maybe that's the point. And to continue the point then, so Wright says this of Wenger in 2014, that he had no issue with the criticism. And then what Wright says is, watching Arsene now is like watching the ageing Muhammad Ali against Larry Holmes, or watching Brazil's Ronaldo when he got fat. You're watching the greats in their demise. The problem with Arsene is that there's no one in his corner prepared to throw in the towel, which is what you and Kev are talking about. But it was what's so striking about that is that Wright, I suspect, if he could find any chink of hope for the redemption of Wenger or Wenger to turn this around, he would absolutely be looking for it. But by comparing him with Larry Holmes or Muhammad Ali at that stage in his career, like, that's it done. You know, what Wright is saying there is no hope. This isn't going to turn around. He's not going to suddenly get the right players and turn this around. It's as inevitable as Ali's demise at that stage of his career. And that really struck me, that even Ian Wright now is holding out 0% hope. It's doomed. It's just a long, horrible demise.
But well, absolutely. But I mean, Wright is completely right. And people have been saying this for a long time. The issue that Wenger's got at the moment is what can he realistically achieve? Okay, to win the Europa League, good achievement, get back in the Champions League. They're 27 points behind Manchester City. Manchester City are playing a football, style of football, that actually, to be fair, most people in the Premier League can only dream of, and Arsenal fans can only dream of. There's a resilience there to Manchester City's football, as well as a style and a class and an elan of David Silva and Kevin De Bruyne. The sadness with Wenger, and I don't want to stray into sort of Shakespearean territory here, but there is a little echo of sort of King Lear and what is it like for a king when he has to leave the throne? What is it like for an individual of Wenger's substance and passion for the job? What has he got in his life? I mean, that's a sort of, it's a terrible thing to say, so he could possibly go and manage France. But Wenger without Arsenal is just, I actually sort of slightly sort of shudder. This is not a Ferguson situation. Ferguson went out on a high in 2013, won the title, had that extraordinary 5-5 against West Brom, and sailed off into the sunset with loads of other things to do. You know what Ferguson's like. He had the racing, he's obsessed with Laurel and Hardy, he's got his wine, he's got his art, he's got millions and millions of friends, contacts, Harvard, whatever, another book. I do slightly worry about what Wenger has in his life after Arsenal. And I do also worry, more pertinently, is that one of the reasons why he's staying on? Because he's like one of the sort of, you know, goodbye to Gloria Swanson, goodbye to Hollywood and all that. What is it going to be like for him when he leaves the stage?
Yeah, that's I think precisely the point that maybe it needs to be asked. I think, Henry, why has, given you and George both spoke about his intelligence and I think about what he did to English football during the mid 90s when he first came in. Is it simply that's it? He doesn't have anything else. Is it the financial rewards that's clearly there for him? Is he just blind to the facts? And is it a slight bit of arrogance that he feels as though he can actually turn this around?
I think he does turn this around. I mean, you know, Kev, you play at the highest level. I think that sportsmen, sportswomen, they always believe in themselves. They're always going to back themselves to turn it around, despite the fact that those of us who are one step away from the action maybe look at it a little bit more cold-eyed, dispassionately, and say, actually, the odds are now so much against Wenger that actually if he continues down this road, it is going to be embarrassing for him. And it's horrible when someone stays on too long on the stage. So, look, it's going to be a very difficult summer for Arsenal. There's so much work that needs to be done behind the scenes, behind the squad, you know, with the squad as well. There are issues at the goalkeeper, centre-half, defensive midfield, arguably another attacker, a wide player. You know, the squad needs addressing as well as the manager himself.
Yeah, quick one then before we let you go, Henry. I just wanted to ask you about England, and I know you're obviously covering England quite a lot now as well. Just in preparation for the World Cup, where are England? Are you happy with everything? And maybe a slight question over Dele Alli again at the weekend as well, given that he's two incidents probably in the space of about 5 minutes this weekend where he was done for diving again. Do you think that's any sort of pressure on him ahead of this World Cup, or do you think everything's fine, everything's in place? Are you happy with everything at the moment?
Well, nothing. I'm fine with England. I mean, I'm not missing an England game since 1993, and probably only about six or seven in that sort of almost 300 games that I've really thought, wow, this is England. You know, Teddy Sheringham was at Wembley yesterday. Think of him, the way he and Shearer played in the 4-1 against Holland, one or two games against sort of Argentina, you know, Croatia, arguably. You know, England have sort of performed occasionally, Germany 5-1, but it's quite rare. So I don't think England go into the tournament with much confidence. In a way, that's quite good. It takes a little bit of the sting and the hype and the media obsession with England. We've got to win at 66 and all that out of the equation. But what I like about Southgate, and I sent him a text when he got the job, I was saying, listen, we spent a lot of time with you sort of, you know, on the media circuit, doing ITV, and was, you know, we spent time with him. And I just sent him a text and saying, look, good luck, but obviously I'm going to have to be critical when England foul up. And he actually was very interesting. He said this a few times in public as well. But no criticism that he will receive will compare to the criticism that he got individually and so collectively with what happened to England after Euro 96, after his penalty miss. So maybe he'll actually go there to Russia and actually be sort of slightly relaxed and take a little bit of a heat out of the situation. Because, look, England have got the players, without a shadow of doubt. The issue is psychologically. But I can absolutely guarantee the first question at his press conference will be, you know, when he announces the squad for the next two friendlies in a couple of weeks' time, will be, are you going to talk to Dele Alli about his diving? Mm. If he brings Jack Wilshere back, are you going to have a little word with him about his diving? And, you know,
the is that a concern for you, Henry? Is it a concern?
Absolutely. Because so if they start doing that, so
what's the concern?
Well, that we've got English players who dive, and
you've realistically always had English players who dived. I mean, diving's been around a long time.
I understand that, but we've got a bit of a collection about it now.
Hmm. But is it not just in keeping with world football, and it's about at the like I it's not great to see, and with Dele Alli, it's taken on almost a comical quality at the moment. But I don't think it's a major worry for England going into a World Cup, really. No.
It's a huge worry. I think, first you want players to be role models. I don't want my kids saying, you know, oh, I like Dele Alli, what a good player, and if he dies, I can dive. I don't think any schoolmaster or school coach would actually appreciate that philosophy. Look, I'm not getting all high and mighty and say the English just because we supposedly invented the game in the Victorian era and we have the oldest football association in the world, that we should actually sort of set a higher benchmark for morals. That is up to every individual country, every individual national association and team to do that. But I don't want to see English players diving.
Mm. The Dele Alli thing is almost comical at this stage. I mean, even if he's just been cynical about it, he should stop for at least a fortnight.
Well, I'd be stopped for the end of his career. Look, I mean, I've known Dele since he was at MK Dons. I did some early work with him on his sort of social media, trying to make sure he sort of behaved on that. You know, there are a lot of people who care about Dele, and he's a fantastic player.
Yeah.
And if England are going to do well at this World Cup, get out the group, maybe last a game in the knockout stage, they're going to need Dele Alli and Harry Kane to click. But if Dele Alli is suspended and sitting in the stands, that's not going to help.
Yeah, I guess that's the other point. He's not particularly good at diving. It tends to be he doesn't actually win a penalty and is lambasted afterwards. It tends to be he gets a yellow card for doing it because the referee has seen it.
Plus, he's going there with a reputation now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, do you know what? Do you want to finish on a good point? And Manchester City, how impressive were they? Because actually, we haven't actually talked about them at all.
Well, they're wonderful. I mean, it's just a joy to watch. You look at the quality of. I mean, I'm sure when the PFA vote for their team of the year, I imagine three of the front six, De Bruyne, David Silva, and Sergio Aguero, will be in there. I mean, they've just been fantastic to watch. And what I love about Guardiola, now a few people have had a little bit of schadenfreude when he didn't win anything in his first season. He got ambushed in one or two places. You know, we're lucky to have him in this country. This is the greatest coach in the world at the moment in terms of vision, in terms of style of football, in terms of track record, in terms of winning things, okay, with fabulous players at Bayern Munich and Barcelona. But, you know, he makes good players better. You've seen what he's done to John Stones, Raheem Sterling, and Kay Arteta's slightly responsible for that. Even Fabian Delph, who we'd all forgotten about, he's turned into a half-decent left-back. Okay, he needs to tackle a bit better. But you know what? He's just a good coach who makes good players great. And that football that he plays is fabulous.
Absolutely. Henry Winter, thanks so much for your time this evening.
My pleasure. Good talking.
Off the ball. This is News Talk.
Are you worried over Dele Alli's diving? Will you stop? What are you worried about?
Well, I'm not worried. I'm asking the question, Joe. That's all it is. It clearly is worried about it, yeah. The only thing he would say with Dele Alli... Can you imagine, though, if they get to the latter stage of the tournament and Dele Alli dives...
And wins a penalty.
No, doesn't win a penalty.
Imagine he does, though.
Gets a second yellow card.
He needs
and
to
then,
get better at diving.
And then he's that's the scapegoat. All... No, but that's that. Yeah, if he wins a penalty, I don't think anyone will give a shite. But I think, in general, can you imagine, Joe, if he dived and he got done for the second yellow?
What he's doing now is clever. He's practising his diving ahead of the World Cup.
Joe,
he's
going
to be great at it.
Come on.
That's what he's doing. And he should be applauded. Michael Owen with a brilliant dive in the World Cup against Argentina to win a penalty.
He won a penalty. Was it last week he won a pen? Who did he win a penalty against last weekend? He won one last week.
Dele Alli.
Yeah, Dele Alli. So it's against Rochdale in the Cup. Won a penalty against Rochdale in the Cup. Yeah.
No one,
he took one step forward to take two steps back with a couple of dives this weekend, didn't he?
Yeah. Pirlo, Maurizio, Pochettino, outfoxed by Michael Owen all those years back in the box. Beckham stood up and hit the penalty. Where was the outcry then? I don't remember it then.
Yeah.
Don't remember the worry then.
No, no.
Stop this diving nonsense. We're not talking about diving anymore. It's absolutely fine.
It'll come up, don't worry. It'll come up again.
Oh, I'm sure. Think of the children.
Yeah.
So listen, the Enright interview is really, really good in a host of levels.
Brilliant.
Did you know a lot of this stuff?
No, didn't know a lot of the stuff at all. It was excellent.
The stuff in Wenger, it's an amazing quote on Wenger, really, when you think about it. But it's more about his upbringing. He grew up in a council estate in South London, and it was really the extent of his family trouble that I was unaware of. So his mum, Nesta Wright, it says here, when Nesta Wright drank, she could not stop herself being mean-spirited, especially to her youngest son, who was Ian. I should have had a termination, his mum used to tell him. At the time, he wasn't sure what a termination was, but he imagined it couldn't be good. And then it goes on to say elsewhere, Ian Wright never had a relationship really with his stepdad, nor with his older brother Nicky or his stepsister Dion. Six people in the family, four of whom seemed like the enemy. So it seems like he had an absolutely dreadful time in his home, which I hadn't realised. And I had seen the video of him with the teacher, Mr. Sidney.
Yeah, I saw that. I watched that document. I watched the documentary,
Where he had Sidney Pidgeon, it seems, the teacher. Lots of people have a great teacher in their upbringing, I suppose. Taught him to read, taught him to write, gave him a sense of self-confidence, gave him advice about his football. Just one of these great teachers. And Wright's doing a documentary of some kind. He's been interviewed in the stand of a stadium, and he's not expecting this at all. It's obviously all planned. Sidney Pidgeon, now retired, comes up behind Ian Wright and says, "Hello, Ian, long time." And Wright turns to him and says, "Mr. Pidgeon, you're alive." He says, "I am alive. How are you doing?" And Wright says, "I can't believe it. Someone says you were dead." And then the unexpected thing is Wright just starts bawling, crying.
Mm.
He takes his hat off, puts it over his head, his face to cover it, and just starts bawling, crying. It's a very extreme reaction given what's happened, but I guess hints at the level of trauma maybe which has gone on there.
Yeah, his story was great, how he actually got into football as well at Palace, how he was basically turning up at the club, you know, turning up, kept on banging on Steve Coppell's door, "Come on, give me a trial, let me in," and then he gave him a trial, and then he offered him a short-term contract.
Yeah.
He had to work his way in. His story is phenomenal.
Three kids at 21.
Yeah.
Father at 18, had three kids by the time he's 21, working as a labourer.
Yeah.
Really, you're not going to be Arsenal's record goal scorer in all likelihood
at
that stage. So really, just an extraordinary story. Has talked about taking his punditry more seriously. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah.
So he joined BBC, it seems. And in the early years of his football punditry, he talked about being encouraged to be funny and be lighthearted. You can imagine that.
Yeah.
You can say, Ian will be funny.
Yeah.
You know, and he started to feel uncomfortable with that. And even mentioned publicly he didn't quite like it. And then the fallout seemed to be very serious. He was told he would never work for the BBC again. And there were 9 years, considering he's on there all the time now.
Yeah, but do you know what?
Nine years where he didn't work for the BBC.
Yeah, I've worked with him a few times, done a few different shows. And he's great fun anyway.
Oh, it's great fun,
He's great fun. But he's one of those lads, he takes his football very seriously. You can tell he loves football, watches, you know one of those people, those lads and who just wants to watch football.
Mm.
And you know, when he's maybe, he has that role, is it a role, I suppose, when he's the joker in the pack,
the
light-hearted one, looking for something different from him. It does become a bit, it's not a great watch. And that's basically what it is, and it gets too much at times. And I think now he's got a nice
balance now, I think.
Yeah.
I really think he sees the game well. I watch his stuff and think, oh.
He is great on strikers. I heard Rich even talking about it yesterday. And he's great on strikers.
Mm.
He's brilliant about thinking about things. And even in that piece there, he speaks about his old teacher telling him about when you're through on goal, get your head up, look to where the space is, pass the ball into the net. You don't have to lash it as hard as you can. Which you and I would be critical of strikers for doing that anyway, wouldn't we? And you see so many that do.
Mm.
You know, that's definitely you. The sort of stuff that you like to get from people as well when you were chatting to them. The thought process when they're through on goal. It's great piece, yeah.
Yeah, I think he is very good. And talked about having to work a lot harder at his punditry and read all the main journalists and list off about 10 or 15.
Yeah.
You say some pundits, you would think...
Oh, Miguel was mentioned there.
Miguel
as well.
Got a mention,
Miguel
yeah,
gets
yeah.
a good mention, yeah. Good.
But you would think some pundits won't be aware of half the journalists. They're just like, oh, look, I'll answer the questions when I go on. He seems to have worked very hard. And then, of course, there's the story at the end.
Oh, but that's a classic. Go on.
Take it away, Joe.
Do you not want to take it away?
No, I'll take it away if you can hand it me. But I just think it's a great piece. It's so good that I was totally unaware of this. And this seems to me like it's almost like the way he's saying it, it's like a throwaway, like it's common knowledge.
You can read it. What the hell?
Yeah, I didn't.
As read by Coban.
Yeah.
I've even highlighted.
But he talks about the first time he got called up for England. So I got called up for England, and I was there amongst the greats: Brian Robson, Shilton, Butcher, Barnes, Lineker, Beardsley, Gascoigne, Platt. And I'm losing the ball in training, and Steve McMahon's giving him a hard time. Effing useless. How do players like you get into the squad? Horrible it was, and it got me down.
By the way, that's outrageous.
Yeah.
Is that commonplace?
Yeah. Yeah.
A player would say to him, "How'd you get in the squad?"
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah. So obviously it's killing him every time he's turning up with the squad.
Even Irish camp less so, or it would happen?
I think, yeah. It wouldn't necessarily have happened that much, no. But it would have felt that bit of pressure coming from the more experienced lads. I certainly would have felt it to an extent, yeah.
Okay.
Not necessarily being as blunt as Steve McMahon saying, effing useless, how do players like you get into the squad?
Yeah.
And he just said, horribly was, it got me down. So years later, he's playing against Man City and we both went in for a tackle. He had to go off. So it's at Highbury, and after the game, he's in the doctor's room, he's getting stitched up. It's his foreskin that's getting stitched. He says, "Righty, you caught me in the wrong place." But he was okay about it.
Oh.
I apologised, wished him well for the rest of the season. And after we retire, I meet him somewhere. And he's saying that every time he goes to pee or he has any form of arousal, he feels a pain and he always thinks of me. And I'm thinking, oh man, that's sweet. It's just classic material, isn't it? Fair play, fair
that's
play. Yeah.
Stuff.
Can you imagine that? Can you imagine it?
Deserves it as well. Delighted. Oh dear. Yeah, it's good stuff. It's worth checking out in the Sunday Times. It's very, very good. Ian Wright, what a man.
Yeah, great stuff.
He would be an ideal roadshow guest.
Yeah, he would. He would, yeah. He'd be very
top,
good.
Top.
Very good. Very, very good, yeah.
Right, it's kind of hard to go back to the football after that, but any final thoughts on the weekend? I know you thought Liverpool are looking
well. We haven't touched on Liverpool, and we'd probably have Liverpool fans get onto us, but Liverpool were very, very good again, particularly that trio up front. Brilliant. Emre Can even behind as well. I don't know what's happening there with him. It certainly looked to me like he's gone to Juventus. That's the word.
He's just running down his contract.
Yeah, he says it's not the case, but certainly playing very well in Liverpool's midfield. But Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain had an impact as well at the weekend. That certainly highlights Arsenal's issues even more so. Yeah. But that front three again, Sané, Salah, Firmino, just absolutely brilliant. Mane, but absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and the latest on Alderweireld is that this thing just looks terrible. Miguel in the London Independent had that Barcelona are going to swoop in and get him at the end of the season for 20 million, 25 million, that's the buyout.
Cut price, yeah.
And there's nothing anyone can do about it. That's the way that's going.
Yeah.
I saw Graeme Souness as well said Dembele is Spurs' best player.
Yeah. But he's been brilliant though, hasn't he? Something I've spoke to Danny Murphy about him over the years and wasn't able to show it consistently. He's someone, to be fair, that even Nathan Murphy
could see it.
Could see that, yeah.
So it's obvious.
It's obvious, yeah. He's always said about Dembele just being that power in midfield, and he is. He's been excellent. He has been excellent, hasn't he?
Mm.
Particularly in that Juve game. How good was he in that Juve game?
I think that's maybe the game, I know that's quite recent, but where a lot of people really took notice of him. It's like a signature statement for performance when you do it at that level.
Yeah.
So that's the situation at Spurs. The football this week is... Anything coming up?
Tomorrow, I'm at Swansea, Chef Wednesday, FA Cup, Joe. You know, I know you love the FA Cup. Did you swear then? Did you actually swear?
For God's sake.
Right, good.
Swansea who?
Swansea Chef Wednesday.
Oh, yeah, no, we'll give you a ring at full time. It's definitely. Leave your phone on, will you?
Yeah, yeah. Ask JP. Yeah, JP's got my number. It's going to be a cold one, Joe, as well. Oh, just think of me.
Delighted.
Oh,
it's me and Dave McIntyre in here tomorrow. Feet up.
Yeah. Yeah, I might give you a call then, yeah.
That's us done for this evening. You can download the full podcast. We had Pat Nevin on earlier on where we talked a bit more about the game at Old Trafford. So that is all there for you. Tom Dunn's on the way. Back tomorrow. A busy show. And OTB AM is here in the morning as well. 7:45. All our social channels is where you can get that show. You can stream it and download clips right across the day. So 7:45 OTB AM. Just check our Twitter or our Facebook Live or Periscope. It's all there for you. So we'll see you tomorrow. Usual time here as well for the radio, 7 o'clock in the evening. Good luck.